All right, on this episode of Pipeline Things, we get into the control room and we have a very special guest, the one maybe who started the spark that created the fire that is Pipeline Things, even if that wasn't—
The mustard seed.
The mustard seed, even if that wasn't his original intent. But let me ask you a question. How familiar are you with control room management, specifically the rule that was created in 2007 and its full adoption in 2012? Or have you ever heard of the rupture rule and its impact on control room management? Or maybe have you ever thought about how closely related integrity management, pipeline integrity management, and what happens in the control room actually are? We get into that. It's a great episode today. We hope you enjoy it. And on this episode of Pipeline Things.
What are you doing?
I was trying to do my own dance this time.
Oh my God.
Wait, you get to make up a dance,
If you're gonna do it, have some rhythm. If not, I'm gonna do like the Hitch thing where he, on the movie Hitch, where he says, just right here, buddy. Right here.
Keep it right here. You know what? We're gonna let the audience judge the quality of the dance that I threw down. And they can rate it. Like, leave your comments on LinkedIn or on the YouTube channel.
Or just text us.
What you think of Rhett's sweet dance moves.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah.
So hey, today, up, you know, it's going to be exciting because we have a great guest coming on talking about a lot of things. I am really pumped about this episode, but the segue.
It's possible that it's his fault that we have Pipeline Things, and we've kind of talked about this a little bit. Like, it's kind of possible.
There's some,
like, he was like the gateway drug for me.
Exactly. He tampered with something he didn't realize, and it just went way beyond what he expected.
And you know how like some people picked up habits during COVID? Like, you know, they're like, and it kind of like transformed them. Like, oh, yeah, because of COVID, I got to do this. Like, I feel like because of COVID, we took away podcasts. So we got some benefit out of it.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, that wasn't the only time, you know, somebody played with something and maybe it went a little further than they thought. You guys had fun family. I know I have to do this. I know you're signed. I told Amanda I was going on the podcast. Yeah. So
this is memorialized now, like, because once this airs, like, it's not coming off the internet.
It's not for sure, but
we could play this at like his wedding or something.
You're gonna play it out there. So tell everybody what happened. Come on, be vulnerable, share family time.
You guys know that we also use the podcast to keep you guys up to date what's going on in Casa de Leon or at the Dotsons. And so we have a newborn, Mateo, and so we're experienced at, you know, the whole baby game. So
baby number quattro.
Yeah, and that's a good job. And so Amanda has done a great job of getting all of these things to help her be, you know, more efficient at being a mom. Yeah. So she has this whole setup of like these bottle brushes now, mm-hmm. like different sizes, different tools and all this fun stuff. And so I'm working and then I just hear Amanda yelling, like, get up. Da, 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 da. You hear the commotion and you can know your mom's, my wife's pitch. And so I'm like, something's going on. I hear Leo screaming, Leo, not Mateo, Leo. My five-year-old, he's screaming, and I'm like, oh, God. So I run over there. I get over there, and the bottle washer is stuck in the back of his head.
We got to, so and for he's, those and who he's don't screaming. Have kids, they have to appreciate the bottle washer is like a Dremel tool with a
yes,
brush
it's a Dremel
attached
tool.
To it.
And so my son's been growing out his hair because his buddy has long hair, so it's probably about 7 or 8 inches long now on the top, and it's just, it's all in there, dude. And it's still spinning. It's spinning. It's rotating. He doesn't know how to turn it off, and it's stuck in his hair. So the whole house is loud, so I finally get it out, and he's missing a solid, like, 2 by 3 inch chunk of hair on the back of the poor kid's head.
And let's just say, now that he's played with that toy, he is never playing with that toy again.
I've thought about giving him a buzz cut just to kind of fix
it. Was tender. I bet you it's still tender back there. I bet you if you go touch his head, I bet you like the whole area is still like really tender.
Yeah, it was a very interesting afternoon yesterday.
Yeah.
Sure.
So if you talk to Chris during this time period, he seems stressed out or tired. It's because you don't know what chaos happened at Casa de
Leon. You know what somebody told me? They were like, "Why would you start a business and have a baby in the same year?"
I'm real curious how you answered that question, but I don't, you know.
YOLO, right? YOLO.
Well, hey, you know, I think it's time because I want to make sure we leave as much time as possible for the person who played with fire and created this podcast that we have today. You know, I guess we owe him an appreciable thanks.
We do.
You know, for what he did for us. So without further ado, I think we need to introduce Russell Treat back, yeah, you know, not down. Back onto our podcast, but onto our podcast.
This time as an invited guest. Yes,
as an invited guest. Oh, so good to be here, guys.
So good to be here.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
I was appreciating the dance steps. I was thinking I might come through with a little Cotton Eye Joe or something. But you know something, guys? This What's doesn't that? Feel quite right.
Oh, okay.
Just 1 second.
I'll be okay. Right back. Did you?
What?
Unplanned moments.
Did Sarah, the Sarah did you?
Podcast.
Oh, okay.
Hey, wait up.
All right. Well,
I thought we had a producer for a reason. If you're not watching.
Where's the quality gate on this?
On YouTube. I think this is the definition.
You know, that feels so much better to me. It seems so much more appropriate. Let's
Russell, would you like to reintroduce the podcast? Yeah. At this point, it feels like
there's something
YouTube.
We need to know.
It's no longer Pipeline Things with your host, Rob Dotson, and Christopher De Leon. I'd like to welcome you to the
Pipeline Podcast Network
with your host, Russell Tree, and your guest, Christopher De Leon and Rob Dotson.
Oh, that's so awesome. This bit is never going to get old, you know. This bit is never going to get old. Thank you for letting me bring the backdrop. I appreciate that, guys. And thank you for the kind words. You know, it's really interesting about the whole podcast thing. You know, we're not really competitors. We're collaborators, no, right?
100%.
You know, we're all trying to do the same thing. We're all trying to put together information for the industry, help people do a better job of being pipeliners. And it's all good. So, anyways, great to be here. Thanks for having me. And thanks for letting me bring the backdrop because, you know.
Well, it was unannounced. But you know what? We'll roll with it. So it is really great to have you on, Russell. And you're absolutely right. Like your content and our content are both complimentary and great. You know, I mean, this past week I came across, and I'll call it out, your episode. I don't remember the number, but it was the one with Michael East on hydrogen. And I loved the dialogue that you and Michael had on hydrogen. And sometimes not always being like you presented, this is what I think is going to happen. And then Michael presented, well, this is what the industry is trying to get to. And it was a great example of something we probably wouldn't tackle, but really enjoyed listening to.
I really love doing this stuff where I don't agree 100% with a guest, which is perfect for this. You know? I think we learn hearing that conflict, right? Mm-hmm. We learn better if there's engagement and disagreement, but you know, honest, intellectual, thoughtful disagreement.
Yeah, to keep our partnership, Rhett and I, healthy, I always try to keep us in debate.
Right.
And not arguing. And there is a difference.
Well, it's healthy conflict, right?
Yeah, healthy conflict.
There's a gentleman that works in my business called Scott Williams. And Scott William and I have worked together for, well, longer than either of us care to admit. He's our lead software developer. And we'll get in a room and we'll be flushing out something we need to do on the roadmap. And we'll come, you know, people will walk by and they'll like, oh, those guys are like in there, they're fighting.
Yeah.
And they're right, we are.
It kind of
But we come out and we're laughing and shaking hands and they don't get it. Says, look, guys, you don't get it. We're not fighting each other. We're fighting together for something.
To get us, right? It's kind of like us talking about cybersecurity policies in our mobile phone devices.
Our employees are like, uh-oh, mom and dad are fighting again.
Yes,
what do we do?
Yes. Cybersecurity, the gift that keeps on giving.
Boy, you are not lying. So, hey, we brought you on for a very specific reason this time around. And I'd like to give you a chance to talk because most people definitely know you as the original Pipeline podcaster.
Yeah.
But our thought in bringing you on this week specifically had to do with dealing with the control room. Mm-hmm. And if you don't mind, I'd like to give you the floor for a little bit and let you describe your background and experiences. Like, why would we bring you on as the expert in control rooms, Russell?
Yeah. So, thanks for that. It's awesome to be a guest. It's kind of a pleasant change of pace.
Are you conflicted in your mind? Like, where's he going? Is he leading this right? Did he lead that?
So my background, I'm an engineer by education, civil. But I've worked in software since really the late or early 80s. I was in the first Air Force unit to automate all its work order and job order process. When I got out of the military, I worked in cryogenics for a bit. And then I worked for a software company where we would find engineering software and commercialize it. I did that for a bunch of years and then transitioned into running a software company doing custody transfer measurement back office. So custody transfer measurement, that's where, you know, you've got a meter and the fluid is changing ownership. And that's somebody's looking at that measurement, making sure it's correct, and then that feeds into the general journal or the invoicing or whatever. So that's kind of how I grew up in the business, right? And when I got into oil and gas, I started doing measurement. I loved it. I ran a software company doing that back office stuff for about 7 years. I left and started Intersys. I started out doing measurement. That's when EFM was just starting to get big. So everybody was putting in radio networks and collecting the data. And then
EFM?
Electronic flow measurement. Thank you. Yeah. Getting off of charts and moving to electronics, particularly the big transmission systems that were adapting to Fork Order 636, which was started in the early 90s, and it changed the big transmission gas companies from buyers and sellers of gas to transporters of gas. Mm-hmm. Right. So measurement and daily measurement started becoming, you know, really important. So that led to looking at the automation, all that kind of stuff. And then people started wanting to put that information on screens in the offices. And then that led to control room. And then I, you know, after doing control room for about 10 years, the whole PHMSA control room management rule came out. And
what time frame is this?
So control room management was originally came out in 2007.
2007.
Right. And it was became effective in 2010 and fully effective in 2012. So during that period of time, we were looking at, well, what do we need to do a better job in the control room for regulated pipelines? What is this rule going to mean? What kind of software tools, what kind of processes are they going to need? And we started building product for that. At that same time, I was also starting to look at leak detection, because whenever you start looking at a regulated liquid pipeline, mm-hmm. leak detection is one of the requirements. So, mm-hmm. you know, my kind of technical path started with measurement, moved into telecoms, moved into HMI, and then started looking at alarm management, high performance human machine interface, and leak detection, right? And that's, so I've kind of become an expert in those fields, because it easily builds up on all the other stuff, yeah. right? So that's a little bit about my background and how I got to know control room. I've probably put control rooms in for more than a dozen regulated pipelines. And I've been involved with close to 30 different pipeline operations, and some in quite a bit of detail.
Wow.
So
appreciate that background. So help me understand a little bit. I've had less awareness of the control room. I've been in probably two or three control rooms. Mm-hmm. But what really sparked this was when we went through the NTSB failure arc that we did, I was very surprised by the important role the control room played in some notable failures.
Yep.
And I feel sometimes like integrity management is a bit removed from the control room sometimes. But when you talk about a failure, both come into play. There's an integrity management component that usually plays a role in the failure. And then the control room usually plays a role in the failure too. And I'm curious what's your opinion of the role between, you know, integrity management and the control room?
It's such a great question.
All I do is ask great questions.
Yeah, no, well, it goes to, you know, I say this a lot, you know, the pipeline world is very technical, and we operate in a lot of hyper vertical domains. And somebody who's doing like deep in the weeds integrity management, and they're doing life calculations and risk calculations and SMICE calculations and all of that, and determining what to dig and when to dig and all that stuff, you know, they're so deep in that detail that it's sometimes hard to look to see the overview of how the pipeline company, how it all fits together, right? So the way I say this, and I say all the time, I'm not an integrity guy, but I've worked closely now with a number of integrity groups on various projects. And integrity management is about leak prevention. Control room management, as it relates to leaks, is about leak detection and response. So if you look at some of the major incidents we've had in the last 10, 15 years, the control room contribution has not been the incident itself,
nope.
but the scope and scale of the consequence, where the control room didn't do nearly as good a job as it could have done to mitigate the outcome. So, you know, integrity management's trying to prevent leaks. Yep. Control room management's trying to mitigate consequences. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a perfect way to paint that picture for us. So if you guys were thinking like, oh, they're good friends, that's why it made sense to bring Russell on it. In fact, no, I mean, it just happened organically, right? Yes. I mean, we went through a handful of failures and that's exactly what we did, right? We're very vertical on the integrity side, right? We start somewhere, we go real deep and we're like, hey, well, you know, if you look at the ILI tour, you look at how they could have responded to this feature or the risk management side of probability of failure really more than anything, right? Whereas the consequence of it was probably more around something more abstract. And we identified that maybe we could have done a little bit better job on the consequence side. And so here you are.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. If you can look at some specific incidents, and one that's probably most people are familiar with is the Marshall incident. And in that incident in particular, you know, there were integrity management issues, but the reason that that incident was so, the scale of the incident was what it was they in the control room, they were struggling with trying to understand, do they have a leak or do they have slackline? And
What they called column separation?
Yeah, same thing. Same thing.
Slackline column separation. Okay.
Yeah. It's basically when the liquid converts to a vapor, given the hydraulics of what's going on inside the line.
Okay.
Gotcha. So, yeah. So, and you know, that's one of the big challenges with leak detection and doing what's called CPM, which is computational pipeline modeling. So you're taking the data from the SCADA system, you're running it into a big math model and it's performing calculations and you're looking at imbalances over 1 minute, 5 minute, 20 minute, right? And if those imbalances get too big, you're like, oh, this I'm going to alarm this as a leak. But the challenge is of the leak alarms we get, very few of them are actually real leaks. They're normally some other kind of operational upset that causes the leak detection algorithm to flag something.
And that's really where I want to go with you today, because you're hitting on so many things. And I remember reading in Marshall, you're right, is a good example, because I think they had some like 60 alarms. It was an incredible number of alarms that they were faced with. And the story, the way it played out, even reading the NTSB report, it was awesome to recount it on the episode, because I was like, I could see myself sitting right there where they were dealing with conflicting information, conflicting opinions, but it played out similarly in other ones, right? Like even in Bellingham, you had challenges with restarting the pipeline and asking questions about whether or not they had a leak. And you had the control room in San Bruno where they were debating whether or not it was an airliner that had crashed. And you know, you had a solid, I think it was 90 minutes, but you had at least 20 minutes where they had the data to believe that they had no upstream pressure increase on the downstream side. They were still sitting there rationalizing, do we have a leak?
Yeah, and if you look at the Southern California Huntington Beach offshore incident, same thing. They were having a whole bunch of process upsets on the pipelines that masked, you know, they were getting leak alarms, but they were also simultaneously having process upsets. And it took them a while to figure out they actually had a leak. So that, you know, and PHMSA put out the rupture detection rule, and they've set some criteria now about what an operator's supposed to do, and you know, without getting into all the detail around it, basically what they've said is you got 30 minutes from the time you think you might have a leak until you shut the pipeline down.
You know what? This is a good time to take a break. I actually want to take a break. And when we get back, I want to actually dive into that rupture detection rule a little bit more and ask you something about the regulations that you mentioned between 2007 and 2012 and talk about how it's impacted the control room. So stay with us. We'll be right back in just a bit as we continue this conversation. All right, welcome back to this edition of the Pipeline Podcaster / Pipeline Things. What pipeline show are we on? Do we know? Did we settle it?
I think we're actually on Pipeline Things, but you know,
it's Russell's show today. So Russell,
no, I'm the guest. I'm clearly the guest. I'm happy to be the guest.
It's nice to
be the guest.
Yeah. But I want you to know, every time there will be a show now, and I see you set up with a camera and a mic, I'm going to sit down.
Oh, respectfully.
Respectfully.
Yeah, respectfully. We know how you operate sometimes.
Exactly.
Russell, I have maybe a comment / question. So again, you know, we consider ourselves integrity SMEs, and I can't help but find this parallel in that from an integrity perspective, you know, what we talk about a lot in our podcast is dealing with uncertainty, dealing with integrating data to make the best decisions possible. And one example of that is dealing with an ILI report. We get an ILI report, there's all these features, and you're having to decipher almost with the information you have, what do I respond to? And I can only imagine someone in the control room is often dealing with that. And we saw this in the failure files, you know, how are these guys, you know, over the course of the last maybe call 4 or 5 major incidents, how are they now better equipped or better trained, or, you know, how has that process changed for them to hone in on what matters?
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about what's in the control room management rule to address that.
Okay.
You know, because that's been around now 10 years and there's a level of maturity starting to happen in the control rooms. There's been a lot of change. Two key things there. One is what they call adequate information.
Okay.
So adequate information is the idea that I got to make sure the control room, the controller has appropriate information to have situational awareness, right? That's a big, big subject, man. Part of that is what you put on the screen and how you put it on the screen for them.
Yeah.
But it's also all these other systems they have access to, plus what other communications are you giving them. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is alarm management, right? Meaning, and this comes out of Bellingham specifically, because Bellingham occurred in the midst of an alarm flood being so many alarms coming in the control room, I can't make heads or tails out of them. So I ignore them in order that I can actually respond to something, right?
Yeah.
So there's been a whole lot done to kind of separate out, these are the things that are really the safety related alarms versus all the other things I might need to know about. Right.
Okay.
To make that stand out, that those things have gotten a lot better in the last 10 years.
So how, cause you mentioned regulation, right? So when something went off for me, when you said adequate information, we have a very similar process in ILI. So when you get an ILI report, you have to issue discovery, and different operators and even different I'll say the police force of regulators, right? So the auditors will have their own interpretation of how and when to issue discovery. So an example, some operators will say, we have to issue discovery within 5 days of receiving a report.
Well,
how does that parallel?
Well, yeah. If you kind of raise up the altitude of the question, you talk about it from a quality management standpoint.
Yeah.
I've got to get from data to information and then from information to decision, right? Same thing in the control room.
Could you pay him for that?
So, well, Rhett, hold on.
Yeah, isn't new, man. I mean, this has been around for 50 years. This comes right out of the work that Deming did, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same thing in the control room. You know, what high performance HMI is about and what alarm management about is practice that's been developed and has been around for a long time and is now being applied to pipelining to do that.
Yeah. Right? So on the integrity space, we see that from an ILI to when you have to issue discovery, there's a maximum of 180 days. And now there's beginning to be some interpretations around, well, you can't just use the whole 180 days, because if you got the ILI report in 45 days, you can't just sit on your hands to issue discovery. Is there anything in regulation from a control room side where it's like, you need to have adequate information and respond by X time?
Yeah, so the rupture rule in my opinion, is an attempt to do that. So when you start talking about leaks, right, just you've got kind of there's different types, right?
Sure.
So the rupture rule gives the operator the ability to define for you what is a rupture. What I would say a rupture is it's a full loss of integrity and containment, right? That's more of an ILI definition. The definition in the control room is something like a pressure change of this much over this period of time,
sure.
Right? To kind of put in the terms of the systems that they use. But the bottom line is the big leap happening quickly.
Full loss is a great way to help get that message across.
Right. So the rupture rule is saying if you get one of those, you need to shut down in 30 minutes. So you have to have a mechanism of defining it. You have to have a mechanism of responding, and that there's got to be some mechanism to have a clock tick down, because you have to have all the valves closed, all the fluids stopped, everything isolated.
Wait, all the valves on the entire system between pump station
around the rupture.
Yeah. So
generally the way that's done is they'll isolate an entire segment.
Okay.
So gotcha. the next natural question I have is, it's 30 minutes enough time?
Oh yeah.
That's interesting. Because, yeah. I mean, just look at the responses that we saw in the failure files.
Yeah, so, I have, and it's really interesting because you mentioned leak versus rupture, and we saw that play out like in Centerville where the leak in that dent was 400 times less than what they could actually detect.
And the SCADA system.
I can appreciate the dent, the difference between a leak and a rupture. But your rupture rule, I want to ask you about that because you've described it twice now in this episode. And when I hear it, I think, man, that sounds, I'm going to use the word heavy-handed, but not in a negative sense, but it sounds very much like PHMSA coming down and saying, yep, I'm going to make you do X, which it sounds like shut down. And I'm curious, rule been effective in achieving the intent? And do you think it's been interpreted and handled the right way? Ooh, I made him think. I
think he's trying to control his response.
I just thought about here's what I'm going to say, and then I'm thinking, well, here's what's going to be heard when I say that. And then I was thinking, and here's what's going to happen when they hear what I think I said. So look, let me put it this way. I'm
going to full edit control on me up.
I'm going to frame it a different way.
Go ahead.
What is the public expectation if there's a rupture in my backyard?
I think it's that it's mitigated as, I'm going to say, as quick as practically possible, right? So obviously, I don't think Marshall is not quick.
Give me, how long do you think it should take if you have a rupture in your backyard?
Minutes.
You know, I mean, not...
Minutes.
Okay, let's say it's definitely not an hour.
Independent of fluid, minutes.
I agree it's definitely not an hour. But then, so you... Look, I'd say it, man. You're both just making an argument for the ASV-ROV rule, right?
That wasn't the question.
I mean...
That was not the question. The question was, what is expectation?
But let's keep going. Yeah. Expectations, minutes. Yeah.
And then you get into, well, what's the practical reality of being able to meet the public expectation?
If you don't have ASV-ROV...
Would say is the rupture rule is moving us in the right direction. It's causing people to get really clear about what a rupture is, and that clarity is necessary for a level of safety performance. It's also causing people to get very clear about what's required in order to identify and isolate a rupture. I want to say one other thing about this, because what you're not asking and should be asking, okay? This is fairly simple if I have a SCADA system, if I have high communication rates and have a good CPM to identify a potential leak quickly and to work through that quickly. Getting that done in 30 minutes is reasonable, particularly for the more mature operators. It's reasonable. There's work to get there and such, but it's reasonable. The risk is not there. The risk is when I restart the pipeline. Okay? So that is a whole different conversation, because the control room's job is to get the pipeline shut down and isolated, and then you've got to follow a process to make sure you don't restart into a leak. Because if you look at these big incidents, you're cleaning that front part up as part of it, but the other part of it is you can't restart into the leak. That's where all the risk is.
So what you're getting to is it's the tether or non-existent tether between integrity management, which is the prevention of full loss and management of consequence on the front end, and managing the consequence. So what's that tether between integrity management and control management?
Now there's a third person in the tether, though, because operations has got to be brought into that conversation, because they're the ones that are going to walk the line or fly the line or see if they can find any indication of leak.
How is that happening? Is that changing?
Well, I mean that's been the practice forever. It's just that's costly and it takes them out of production and it can be difficult to do. Yeah. And it's not perfect.
Yeah.
Right? Cuz depending on the rupture and where it's located, you might not get an immediate indication. Particularly if you shut the line down, you don't know where it is until you pump enough fluid out.
Yeah.
So, it's a challenging problem. It's a challenging problem.
Yeah. It just as an example of that tether, right? I mean, we saw that with Centerville, right? Where the senior integrity engineer said, hey, there's a dent call here in the ILI report, go check it out. And then they found the leak, right?
Out, like, so six of them. And
just that tether is becoming more and more clear. I want to ask one
more question. Yeah, no, I think that's where we're headed is it's going to be that if we get a leak alarm and shut down, then what's the appropriate rigor before restart?
And I was curious where we're moving there to make improvement, because you're right. That was related directly to Marshall. And I remember there were multiple 911 calls, and it was eventually a consumer's employee who found the issue. And so I was thinking in my mind, like, well, I remember they had to escalate. They didn't want to walk the full line in that particular instance. So things must have changed since Marshall and now.
Well, and if you look at Marshall and Amplify, the one on Southern California, yeah. both of those were underwater. Marshall in a swamp, yeah. and you know, the Huntington Beach one offshore. So, you know, you can't walk that line.
Yeah.
And, you know, the one off Huntington Beach was at night. So how do you find an indication at night, right? So these things are not simple. The rupture, the identifying the potential defects, you know, finding the features and the features requiring evaluation and the defects and all that, that's one part. Shutting the line down if you think you may have a leak is another part. But the risk we have in the industry, and I think our response is fairly immature here yet, is how do I restart with certainty I'm not restarting into a leak?
I don't have an answer for the question.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for that one either.
I want to touch on one more point. You mentioned adequate information. That I thought you were going to go a different direction, Chris, when you asked that question. For me, that's data integration that we deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like data integration is never complete. It feels like it's almost never adequate because you always feel like, oh, well, I could integrate this information. I could integrate this information. Like when you think about geohazards, which is an emerging threat for us. Well, oh, if I would have integrated the rainfall. Oh, if I had integrated the fact that this operator had an issue. Oh, and historically, if I talked to the field guys and I had integrated the fact that, oh, we had done a regrading of the right of way here, it feels like you could go back endlessly in terms of data integration. And I'm curious if y'all face the same problem.
Well, you do. You absolutely do. Because, you know, there's like, well, I want to know that there's work going on the right of way.
So how many screens do you put up in front of them? Do you put up like 30 screens? And then you can't focus on 30 screens.
Yeah, that's high performance HMIs. What do you put on the screens? How do you arrange the screens? How do you navigate through all the data?
And that's where I wanted to go with it, right? Because I keep wanting to draw these parallels to what we do, right, on pipeline things, which is ILI. So I'll kind of try to frame it this way. In ILI, over the last 30 years, we've seen improvement in sensoric technology, right? Mechatronics, right? Mm-hmm. Calipers with sensors. And then now it's moving towards how to use machine learning to avoid some human error. Right.
Yep.
I see so many parallels with you guys in control management. So, and on your side, on the control management, where are we seeing a lot of the innovation? Is it in data acquisition systems? Is it in algorithms? Is it in the way mechanics?
Yeah. So the man, again, a great question. We're kind of, I could spend 30 minutes just talking about that. I've done a couple of projects on control room of the future and what does that look like? And you know, it would take a while to unpack all that. But what I would say is there's a lot of work being done. Mm. There's a company out there called Crux OCM. They're doing kind of robotic control, kind of autopilot for pipeline operations. And it's designed to take highly high cognitive load. Got to think hard to do it, right? For you Texans out there, got to think hard to do it. Anyways, high cognitive load type tasks, like starting up a long transmission pipeline. You know, I got to sequence the pumps the right way. I got to understand the densities of the fluid. I got to make sure that I keep everything's within pressure bounds. Well, I can automate all that. Just hit one button. And now what do I ask the controller to do if they don't have to spend all that time doing that start? And where does that attention go, right? Yeah. And then the other thing is, I think there's probably an equivalent opportunity because most of the alarm leak, particularly in leak alarming off of CPMs, your false alarm rate, meaning it's not a leak, but it's a legitimate hydraulic condition.
Sure.
Okay. Not a false alarm, like I shouldn't get that alarm at all, but I have a hydraulic condition, but it's not a leak. There's probably an opportunity to apply automation and artificial intelligence to that in order to quickly rule out hydraulic conditions.
Yeah.
Which anything we do like that so that I can take and my alarm count goes from 10 a month to 2 a month.
Yeah. And
that's a big deal.
And that really allows, what goes to my mind is that's where like things like instead of neural networks or something like that, you can use supervised machine learning, right? Where there's still a human component where the
well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. What I would say is ultimately what you're trying to do is you're trying to get the human being working on the problem that's uniquely suited to the human being, right? So where are the, you know, for this integrity engineer within their scope of control, where are the 3 to 7 most significant features requiring investigation.
Yeah.
Right.
Process escalation.
Right.
It makes perfect sense.
You know, the same thing in the control room. Where are these alarms that really need to be looked at and looked at quickly?
Yeah.
Right. So
I think we've done a good job.
I've really enjoyed
this episode. He's done a good job.
It's been a lot of fun, even if the Pipeliners podcast semi-hijacked it. It was a welcome hijack. Russell, I really want to thank you for coming on and joining us. You, I'm certain this won't be the last time that we intersect on a podcast again. And want to thank you for supplementing, you know, our knowledge on the control room side for sure. So well, you have one last question statement you'd like to make?
No, I just want to shout out to you guys. Look, I think what y'all are doing with Pipeline Things is great. You guys have kind of raised the bar as to production level because I'm still purely audio and you guys are doing all this fancy video stuff. But no, look, I think what you're doing is great. I love having these kind of conversations. I think that one of the things we can do, you know, as a community, not just us, but as a community in the pipeline world is how do we get people to kind of cross collaborate, right? Because, you know, when we have an incident, it's not a single, it's not integrity that failed. It's not control room that failed. It's not operations that's failed. It's the entire system that failed. And how do we collaborate more effectively at that level?
Well, we're leading by example today, aren't we?
Well, we're certainly asking questions and kind of noodling on what the challenges are. I don't know that we came up with any solutions.
No, but it starts with collaboration. It's not our podcast or your podcast, right? It's mingling and and what do we call it?
It's
right?
The Violent Pipeline Things podcast. So on that note, I want to say, you know, again, thanks for joining us. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode of Pipeline Things, and we look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks. I am your host, Rhett Dotson, with my co-host, Christopher DeLeon, and our guest, Mr. Russell Treat. Thank you very much.